certainly good to see all of you this morning. We're glad that you're here and excited about our study of the 17th chapter of the book of Acts. Lots of great things in this chapter. We'll talk about them. All right, in the 17th chapter of the book of Acts, we've noted that the apostle went to the city of Thessalonica. Things did not go well. He went from there to Berea. We've talked about the Bereans receiving the word with a ready mind, and they examined or studied the scriptures daily to find out whether or not the things they were being taught were accurate. And we then followed Paul from Berea to Athens. And in Athens, he sent word back to Berea, where he had left who? Silas and Timothy. Left Silas and Timothy in Athens to come with all speed. Is there evidence that they did? Yes, yes, they came with all speed. And how would we know that? We find that out in the book of Acts.
As soon as possible they left.
All right. Well, we find that out essentially in the First Thessalonian letter, because Paul sent Timothy back to Thessalonica from Berea, or from Athens, to be left in Athens alone, as the text tells. And there's evidence then that Silas joined Paul as well, and then Silas and Timothy, returning from up in Macedonia, joined Paul over in the city of Corinth. We'll talk more about that when we get to the 18th chapter. But in this 17th chapter, we know that Paul encountered a city that is described as being filled with idols. And it tells us that his spirit was provoked within him when he saw the things that were going on in Athens. Now, one of the things that I try to fix in my mind is what Paul likely saw when he was traveling from the coast, the two-mile journey inland to the city of Athens. And we saw some pictures earlier in our study. We'll not reiterate all of that, but to see even the remains of the great buildings that were used to house the idols where these people worshiped represented a great deal of investment of time and energy and especially money in the furtherance of these the worship of these idols. Now, in the city of Athens, we noted that the Apostle Paul encountered not only the Jews in the synagogue, as we have noted his custom was, but he also encountered folks in the marketplace, which indicates a general audience that was composed of, as we see in the text, Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. And we noted that those in the city of Athens, according to what is it, verse 21, that they, well, that's chapter 18, no wonder. Now, all the Athenians and strangers there spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or to hear some new thing. So they want to see what Paul has to say. Now, the fact that the city seems to be overrun with philosophy, I think prompts at least some kind of an understanding of the thinking of the citizens of the ancient world at that time, and in particular in the city of Athens. When he encounters these philosophers, that I think gives us a good cross-section idea of the kind of thinking that characterized the ancient world. And what was it? We have two represented here, the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. We've talked a little bit about the difference in thinking, but what was the general thinking of people of the ancient world that's represented here in Athens? Noah?
Greek mythology.
Greek mythology, yes, yes. And so what we have is a skewed concept of God, but where does their thinking actually begin? With that which is divine intelligence or matter?
I don't understand the question.
Okay. Well, you know, and I think that's a good thing right here, Claire. Their thinking did not begin with God. Their thinking began with what you see is what there is, and that's eternal. So as they would look at the universe, or what was called the cosmos, it's eternal. It's always been. Randy?
And what they're doing is they're starting with that which they can see and hear
yeah.
and observe.
Yeah.
They have no grasp of the unseen, the spiritual world.
That's right. No grasp at all on that. Now, the thing that I think we need to take home about that. And I know there's some distinctions between the thinking of the Epicurean and Stoic philosophers. But the thing that we want to take home is the thing that they had in common. Sometimes we want to separate them and talk about the various things that made them distinct. But the thing that made them common is astounding. If you'll take a look at the board, neither believed in a divine creation. And neither believed, therefore, in any kind of final judgment or day of reckoning or day of accounting. Now, with the Epicureans, that spells into what we have quoted in 1 Corinthians 15. Let's just eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. That's all there is. And then the Stoics, much like the Pharisees of New Testament times, they thought that their righteousness had its own rewards in this life. If you do good things, then you'll have a good life. And that was their motivation. Not that a divine being gave commands that must be obeyed or promises of eternal life. They didn't accept that. Randy?
I was just thinking of 1 Corinthians chapter 1 when Paul says in verse 22, "For indeed Jews ask for signs and Greeks search for wisdom. We preach Christ crucified. To Jews a stumbling block, the Gentiles foolishness."
Yeah.
The Greeks, they're all sort of wrapped up in one here, but it says they're seeking after wisdom. That's what all these philosophers are.
That's what it's about.
They're making it up as they go.
Making it up as they go. And Claire, that's the relevance of this, and it's the relevance of Paul's response. He's responding not necessarily to each individual thing that makes them distinct, but he's responding to the things that they share in common, their way of thinking about things. Let me illustrate. Have you ever talked with somebody about, let's say spiritual things, that just basically have no concept at all of what the Bible says or of a divine being, what his attributes are? And so, essentially, when you're trying to study with somebody like that, you have to start somewhere else. It's difficult to just start with the Bible. Maybe you try to study with somebody that did not believe in God. Well, it's pointless then to start essentially with the Bible, assuming it's the Word of God when they don't believe in God. And that's what you have in Athens. You've got people who really don't believe in a divine, eternal being that's responsible for everything. You've got people that believe that the things that you see, the material universe, just always has been. Now, here's the point I want us to remember in this. How does that really differ from modernistic thinking? We think we're smart, you see, and we think our world is unique, and there are questions that men have sought to answer, and they've always sought to answer these questions, and we're going to look at them in just a moment. And that's not anything new, but when you start at the wrong place, you're going to end up at the wrong place every single time. And we ought not be surprised then that these who share this in common as a starting place, they might wind up at different places in their thinking. But they share this common ground, and wherever they wind up, it's not going to be right because they didn't start right. Okay? I think I saw your hand and Bruce's hand. Okay.
It just seemed like when you talk about people from past times, their philosophy a lot of times seems to start inside, that they are the center. Like, we used to think that the Earth was the center of the universe.
Right.
They seem to think they're the center, and so what they think and what they do are the rules for everything else.
Well, that's right. That's right. Bruce?
No, the problem you have with the ignorance is basically a lack of knowledge. Total lack of knowledge of creation, total lack of knowledge of what's going to happen in the end.
Well, that's right, but as we were looking at this chart last time, as we introduced some of these things, one of the things that we noted is here you have a city that's filled with learning. I mean, we're not talking about stupid people. Well, we're talking about people that have a great deal of intellect. They've studied and studied and studied, and we've illustrated that with the fellow that Richard and I studied with several years ago. And just simply because somebody is ignorant as it pertains to these questions, doesn't mean that they're lacking mentally in their ability to reason or their ability to understand. It's just that they don't know. Now, let's not conclude that the Bible, or starting with God, is somehow unreasonable or difficult to know. Paul deals with that in this sermon that he presents to these Athenians. But when you are interested in trying to answer the purpose of why you're here, what you're to do, these are questions that I don't care what generation you live in, whether it's ancient or modern, you're going to grapple with these kinds of questions. What's the nature of the universe? Is it eternal? Or did it have a beginning? Now, just as simple as I know how to make it, have you ever tried to talk with somebody that is an evolutionist, for example? And they talk, and often in our school systems and so forth, begin with the existence of matter, and there was this big explosion, and you're familiar with some of that. I know you've heard that. But in order for there to be a so-called Big Bang, there had to be something to go bang. And so you begin with matter, and that's where these folks began. You see, that's not new. We think sometimes in all of our intelligent philosophers that teach our science classes and that sort of thing, that this is a new question. It's not a new question. It's been even in the ancient times of Paul. Is the universe, the cosmos, as they refer to it, or we refer to it, is it eternal? Or is there an intelligent, divine being that is eternal? Now, you go one way or the other. There's not a middle ground on that. Now, here's the next question. What's the purpose of life? What's the purpose of man? Now, if you begin with God, you don't have any difficulty answering that. But if you begin that the universe is eternal, then why are you here? What are you supposed to do with your life? What gives it meaning and purpose? And do you see how that where you start would dramatically affect how you answer this question? And then the next question. If you begin with unintelligent matter, rock, let's say, something that goes bang, then how do you define what truth is? Is there anything that becomes absolute, or is this just a variable in your philosophy? Depends on your experiences, how you define truth. And then this next question. How do you determine anything to be morally right or wrong? Now, even the Epicureans and the Stoics, they had answers for these things, but they weren't always the same answer. But you see, by looking at the questions, beginning with, let's say, the universe is eternal, then you determine what's right or wrong by what in modern times has been referred to as situation ethics. It's just up to you. If it feels good to you, then it's okay. If you don't have a conscience problem with it, then it's okay. But what determines what your conscience dictates? Well, your experiences and ultimately the life that you have chosen to live has determined that. There's not a real absolute standard. Now, we studied a while back in a lesson that I presented on pleasing God. Any of you remember that? Well, I just immediately want to see every hand go. Nobody remembers my lesson on pleasing God. Okay, I'll preach it again. Pleasing God. You see, that's the purpose of your life. We know and have studied many times from Ecclesiastes chapter 12 that what is the purpose of life? That's right. Now, why? Well, that's right, but why? Next verse. Verse 14. For God will bring every work into judgment, whether it be good or whether it be evil or bad. And you see, this begins with the existence of God. That gives meaning to your life. It answers this question. It determines the moral correctness or incorrectness of things that you should or should not do when you begin with God. And you've always got the same answer. It becomes an absolute standard. But when you begin with the universe as eternal, then you have variables in all of these questions, don't you? All right? Now, that's what Paul's facing in the city of Athens. I said all that to say this. You know, sometimes we think that our Bible study is just, well, I had one fellow use the expression creed rehearsal, and that's just wrong. The Bible is relevant. It's relevant to your life and mine. And the things that are revealed in the Bible are crucial in making decisions about how you live your life and how you can maybe help somebody else to live their life in a way that's pleasing to God. But you've got to start at the right place. Now, the Apostle Paul, you think he went into the city of Athens and picked up a New Testament and started reading it to them? Well, no. No, he couldn't do that. And to these Epicurean and Stoic philosophers, do you see him quoting Old Testament scripture like he did when he went into the Jewish synagogues? Well, now why not? Well, they didn't believe that, and they didn't know it to begin with. Now, there's lessons there. One of the things that we've described as an approach, and the main approach that I want to make in our study this time through at the book of Acts, is how you can use it to teach somebody to become a Christian and to live a righteous life as a Christian. And this chapter is just absolutely right up near the top of the list of things you need to know, because you're looking at a world the same as Paul looked at his world. Not any real difference. And we might look around about us and say, well, we don't have all these great big fancy buildings. You don't have to look very far to see fancy buildings. But these buildings that you're looking at least for the most part, are recognized by denominational people as places of worship to God. But that was not true in Athens. But the things that Paul addresses in Athens are exactly the same things that we need to be addressing. And we want to see that, to answer these questions. Now, in view of that, I want us to look at the text as Paul presents it to these people. In verse 22, he said to them, "I perceive that in all things you are very religious. For as I passed along and observed the objects of your worship, I found also an altar with this inscription, 'To an unknown God.' What therefore you worship in ignorance, this I set forth unto you." Now, again, we made this point last time. I want to reiterate it because of the context. Paul is not necessarily contrasting one God versus multiple gods. That's not the point just here. Paul's point just here is to identify to them God. They do not know God. Now, in previous studies, we've talked about knowing God and how you come to know God. And in our Wednesday night study, we've talked about the coming of Jesus, and one of the purposes of Jesus' coming is to make known to man his Father, to make known God. You see God in him, as he is a manifestation, as it were, of the characteristics of his Father. And we talked about that Wednesday night. But the emphasis in our study this morning, and I think the emphasis in Paul's presentation here in Athens, is on this word unknown. There is a God you don't know anything about. You worship him in ignorance.
One point that you brought out is that they didn't have any concept of a God as the creator of all. Their gods that they worshipped were kind of like uber humans that had all these strengths. They had human foibles, just, you know, they got themselves into trouble and they acted like humans. They weren't anything like the God of the Old Testament.
Right? And their involvement in your life. You know, it's almost like here is the family of the gods, and they're over here, and they do their thing, and they have their shortcomings, ups and downs, and problems and all that. And then here's your life over here, and they have no involvement in it. And that becomes a point that Paul addresses in this presentation.
Whenever we get to this point, this chapter, I remember it seems like it was a gospel meeting years ago, Gary Johnson or... I honestly don't remember, made the point that it was illegal in ancient Rome, well, this time, during this time, to introduce any new gods. They passed a law that said you can't introduce any more gods.
Yeah.
As many gods as we have right now, that's as many as there are.
Well,
there aren't any others.
Yeah.
And so, from that standpoint, he doesn't introduce a new god. He takes one that they already have acknowledged that exists.
True.
The unknown God.
Yeah.
and explains into that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's right. One of the things that, as I understand from study, that the Romans, that prompted this by the Romans, no new gods, no new forms of worship and that sort of thing, was it creates problems. And Rome didn't want any problems. And that was one of the things that we've seen illustrated in what we've studied so far. You know, they're promoting of this. They teach against Moses. They teach against the law. And so it creates a problem. That's why that those who were identified as Christians were identified as a sect. They believed that this was a part of something else. And the Lord's church is not a part of anything. It was something that was prophesied in the Old Testament to be separate and independent. It's not something that's a part of Judaism. But that's how it was perceived during that time. And then when it became apparent that's not it, now we've got problems, big time problems, with these accusations. But yes, that's right. Now, I want you to look, we pointed this out last Sunday, at the word that's used here to translate our word unknown. And you've got that in Athens. You've got people today. I don't know whether there's a God or not. This is what I do. This is what governs my life. And so you've got the same kind of ignorance that existed then, also exists now, and on the same basis. Just haven't been taught any different. Now, if you're going to teach somebody anything, Carolyn, about English or math or science, what do? You want them to have an accurate understanding of this. Can you just let everybody be the standard? How do you boil all that down to there's a standard that governs English or math or science or... how do you do that?
You have to go to some known authority on the subject.
Oh, you have to recognize something as evidence to support what you're presenting. And that's what Paul does. Here is a God you don't know anything about. I'm going to tell you about this God that you worship in ignorance. Number one, he is creative. Now, oh boy, you look again at the text. He is creative. I perceive that you're very religious, but in verse 24, the God that made the world and all things therein, he being Lord of heaven and earth, dwelleth not in temples made with hands. Now, you could spend a month of Sundays just talking about that one verse. The God. All right, now we're not talking about multiple gods anymore. We're talking about this God that you don't know anything about. You see. Well, what did he do? He made the world. And everything in it. Now, if you believed in this multiple God concept that characterized the people of Athens, what would that do to your philosophy, Claire? We believe that there's a God of the ocean, a God of the mountains, a God of the plains, and even in Old Testament times, you remember, there were those who said, well, we can't fight against their God because he's the God of the plains. And, you know, we're mountain folks, and so let's go down to the plains and or go to take the fight to the mountains or so forth. I may have that turned around. But the point is, they believed in God being geographic. Now, if somebody stood before you and that was your philosophy, and they said, you know, there is a God that's God of everything. In fact, he made it all. What would that do to your thinking? I'd just blow your mind. You know, the circuits would start to short circuit. That's just so foreign to anything you've ever heard before. You mean there's a God that is creative? Now, what does that suggest about the cosmos? When you look at the world and the sky, the stars and the sun, and, you know, we've got intelligent people that even during those times were astrologers and had figured out the motion of the stars and planets and things of that nature. I mean, we're talking about intelligent people. And now you're telling them that hasn't always been. It hasn't always been that way. There is a God that made it that way. Do you see that one statement has just shipwrecked everything you've believed all your life? You mean this hasn't always been? Now, in one word, how would you answer that? No, it hadn't always been. God made it. There is a God that you don't know anything about. And that God is creator. All right, now having said that, let's look back at the passage. It says, he being Lord of heaven and earth. What's the word Lord mean? Ruler, master. What does he rule or master?
Everything.
Heaven and earth. Now that's going to become relevant in just a little bit when we talk about his involvement in your life. He made everything that is, and he is the Lord of everything that is. He's the master of the universe. Well, what does that in itself tell you about God? He controls everything because he designed it that way. Now, instead of beginning with a rock over here, I mean, you can set a rock on that table and expect it to come into some kind of life form existence, and you can just sit there and watch that rock till you get old and die, and it'll still be a rock. Generation after generation, they just spend their time and nothing else watching that rock, waiting for it to disappear. It's never going to do a thing because it's a rock. It doesn't have life. But now we're talking about a God that can create. And not only can he create, but he can create with intimate design. I know that some of my health issues, and I have some personal experiences that demonstrate some things, and they're familiar with me. When I was in the hospital having one of the procedures done before the heart surgery, the doctor came in and was explaining what he was going to do. And it's rather interesting to me because he said, what we'll do is we'll go up through this artery into your heart. And he said, given the right side of the heart, it's not a real hard thing. But he said, we've got some work to do over on the left side over here. And going from one side to the other side, he said, that gets a bit complicated at times. Okay, you got my attention. How are you going to do this? He said, well, there's a little hole there that has a little flap over it. And he said, we'll push through that little hole and go into the other side, and we'll work on the left side. And when we pull our instruments out, that little hole will close up. I said, you mean that little hole that God put there? That when the mama gives birth to the child, and the child goes and starts crying, and the oxygenation is changed from the supply that the mother has now to the supply that is in the baby's lungs, and that oxygenates the baby's lungs, and now I've got oxygenated blood running through the heart. He said, yeah, that's the little hub. Now I want you to think for just a moment. You think that little hole happened by chance? Or that it evolved? It had to work absolutely perfect the very first time or there would be no life. You see, it couldn't evolve gradually over a period of a kajillion years, could it? Design. Well, that's just that one little valve in your heart that goes open and closed, and it's closed in from then on until some doctor runs a tube through it.
I have frequently marveled how there are two types of individuals that can truly be atheists. One is astronomy.
Yeah.
When you look at the depth of space, the distance between how vast it is out there, as Carl Sagan used to say, billions and billions of stars.
Yeah.
It's got, you cannot look at that and say it all happened by chance.
No.
You see a design. The second class of individual would be a medical doctor.
Yeah.
How do you look at the human body,
yeah,
and see all the intricacies and say, oh, well, it just happened by chance?
Well, it was encouraging to me, and I'll use my word, quite fascinating. And talking with the doctor about these things, and then after some of the other surgeries, to comment about how that we are made, we are fearfully and wonderfully made. And the doctor said, that's right. God made us that way. And, you know, I don't know anything about that man's religion, but he believes in God. And what we want to know is, these in Athens, they didn't believe in this kind of an eternal being.
When I was a Catholic, the word saint was important. And then when I became a member of God's church, when I found out what saint really means, it surprised me.
Yeah.
But there's people that I knew in the Catholic faith that simply refused to believe it.
Yeah.
And then there were those who were curious, like me.
Yeah.
So it's similar to that. It reminds me of those people, how much they must have gone against the Christians that were there.
Well, you know, strangely enough, Claire, people believe often what they are taught to believe. Right or wrong, that's just the way that is. That's what makes our teaching so critical. Paul said to Timothy, take heed to thyself and to thy teaching. For in doing this, thou shalt save both thyself and them that hear thee. You can't just teach anything. It has to be right, and we've got to be careful about that. James emphasized that in James chapter 1. Yes, chapter 3, verse 1.
Along the same lines of how all of this was a shock to everyone, the words that Paul uses here, that this God is Lord of both earth and sky.
That's right.
They had, or sea and sky, that's what it was. They had Neptune, and he was in charge of the sea. He had no authority up in the sky. And in Jupiter, he was in charge of the sky. He couldn't do anything down in the sea.
Yeah.
And Paul's there saying, this God you don't know anything about, he controls it all.
He controls it all. Karen?
I think, too, sometimes people who have these other beliefs, they're not entirely certain what they believe or how to talk about it to the level that last semester I took this anatomy class that I learned way more about swallowing than you can even imagine. And in the textbook, it would say, in one paragraph, it would say, you know, the such and such developed down through evolution, blah, 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 what you might expect in a college textbook. The very next paragraph, it would say, the such and such system was designed, blah, blah, blah. And it's like, now, wait a minute. You just said two completely different things.
Yeah.
But I think sometimes they don't even really think about it. They're so busy looking at, you know, the amazing world that is, that they don't think, where did this all come from? How did it
You see the confusion, and there's always that confusion, even in Athens. The Athenians and strangers, they spent their time in nothing else but either to tell or some or hear some new thing. They're searching, they're constant because of this confusion. Richard?
Yes, these comments just reminded me. We had a visitor here once, and he visited one time. He was here for class and the sermon. And at the end, I remember him saying to you, this is a teaching church. I thought, you know, there's a lot of churches that are not teaching churches.
Well, that's true.
You believe what I tell you,
yeah.
And that's all there is to it.
Yeah.
You know, you have to be a student of the Bible in order to be acceptable to God.
And the irony of that is we understand that concept when it comes to math and science and English and all this kind of thing. But when it comes to knowing what this book says, we just depend on somebody to tell us. And there's confusion because we don't study. Now, that's a good point. But Paul is telling them there is a God that created, novel thought, everything that is, and he rules everything that is. He is Lord of heaven and earth. Now, another thing that we want to notice about the God that Paul is declaring to them is seen in, let me get my place on my notes, in verse 25, I'm sorry, verse 24, he dwelleth not in temples made by hands. I punched the button a little too soon. He dwells not in temples made by hands. We'll just take that off for now. But not only has he created it, but he don't live where you think he lives. Now, somebody pointed out Jupiter and Neptune being God of the sea or God of the stars and the planets and that sort of thing. Here you've got these temples that you think gods live in. But there is a God, he don't live in something like this. Now you may remember when David wanted to build a temple. God made a comment to David, something about that he did not ask him to build a temple. This was David's idea. Now my question to you is this. Was it necessary for there to be a temple in order for God to dwell among his people? Well, no. Do we build a temple for him? No. Now, what is his temple? All right, the heart, or the church, as we might think of it. And we see that in Ephesians chapter 2, how that we're described, the Jews and the Gentiles, specifically in that text, we're described as stones in the temple. That's what you are. And so, yes, God has a temple, but it's not a physical structure, and He doesn't need a physical structure to dwell with His people. And that's the thing that Paul is emphasizing to these people. But the pictures that we saw last week of the ruins of some of the ancient temples there, I'd like to see them. They're just absolutely amazing. What you read about them in terms of size and the investment and the materials that were used to build these magnificent structures. Can you even begin to imagine how much they cost? And now here's somebody telling you, God's not there. He's not over here. And He's not inside of that thing. You don't have to build all these things to manifest God's presence. Why? Well, He doesn't live in houses like that. That's not the God that exists. And as he elaborates further on these things, in verse 25, then, he says, neither is he served by men's hands as though he needed anything. Well, we want to talk about that because it indicates that he's self-sustaining. You see, he's not dependent on his existence on you. Now, what about these Greek gods that they worship? When we even look at the temples, the ruins that are there, what do we know from New Testament times till now has happened to those temples? They've crumbled. They don't last forever. Now, they'll last as long as you maintain them. But when you stop maintaining them, what happens to them? They die. They crumble. They decay. But the God, Paul says, that I'm telling you about, He doesn't dwell in that, and He's not served with men's hands. Now, the irony of that, and I think the foolishness of that, we'll hit on this point again, we'll read the passages now. But if you'll turn your Bible to Psalms chapter 115, I mark this passage in my Bible because I don't want to forget where it is. Sometimes I do. But Psalms chapter 115, if you'll note verses 4 through verse 8, you see an idol described. And the relevance of that to our text is astounding. Paul said in verse 4 of Psalms 115. Pardon me?
Probably wasn't Paul.
Probably wasn't Paul. No, did I say Paul? It wasn't Paul. No, Paul didn't say this, but the psalmist did. And Psalms 115, verse 4, it says, their idols are silver and gold, the work of men's hands. They have mouths, but they speak not. Eyes have they, but they see not. They have ears, but they hear not. Noses have they, but they smell not. They have hands, but they handle not. Feet have they, but they walk not. Neither speak they through their throat. They that make them shall be like unto them. Yea, everyone that trusteth in them. Now, as you look at that carefully, you've got this thing over here that man has built. And you're going to attribute to it the characteristics of God. But in order for it to be even in existence, what happened to what had to happen? Man made it. So you're not the product of it, but it's the product of you. You created your God. That's what it is. Paul's telling these folks in Athens, that's not the way it is. God made you. But pertaining to idols, you made them. Now, regarding the idol, how is it sustained? Well, you have to maintain it. And if you don't, it'll lie in ruins, it'll decay. But that's not true, you see, of God, because He made all that is. He's self-sufficient and self-sustaining. But these idols, in order for it to go anywhere, how does it get from point A to point B? Sarah, what do you think about that? Well, it won't go by itself, no. You've got to move it. And in order for it to say anything, how does it speak? You've got something over here carved out of a rock. How does it speak?
They have to say it.
Well, they have to say it. So whatever its will is and whatever it expresses comes from man, not from the idol. It says that they have eyes, but they can't see. It says they have a nose, but you see they can't smell anything. They have hands, but they can't do anything. Now, you're going to bow yourself down before that thing and attribute to it attributes of deity?
They're made in the image of man.
Yes, they are. Yes, they are. Now, Isaiah speaks of a similar practice, a little bit different time, but a similar practice in the history of Israel. In Isaiah chapter 44, and I'd encourage you just to read the whole chapter, but we'll just kind of paraphrase it, beginning about verse 9 through the next several verses. He describes a man that goes to a forge. You know what a forge is? Where they hammer out metal. That's right. And so here's a man that takes a piece of iron and he sticks it in the coals and he hammers out an axe head. And then he takes the axe head that he's made, puts it on the handle, goes into the woods, and he chops down a tree. Now that's a good use for an axe, isn't it? But he chops down a tree. And from the tree that he chopped down, he cuts up firewood so he can get warm and cook his meal. And from the same tree, he takes the axe that he made and he carves out this idol and he falls down before it and worships it and calls it God. Now that's just the height of ignorance, isn't it? That's what you've got in Athens. That's just exactly what you've got in Athens. Now we look at that and we say, well, what a foolish person. Can't he see that it's a tree just like all these other trees? And can't he see that even the very axe that he cut it down with was one that he made? And that this image that he made is nothing more than firewood? Can he see that? No. Now why couldn't he see it? Well, he didn't want to.
Verse 18, in their context, they know not, neither do they consider, for he has shut their eyes, and they cannot see, and their hearts that they cannot understand.
All right. Blind. They're just blind. Now, is that what you've got in Athens? Essentially the same. Yes, that's what's created this atmosphere that Paul is in. He's attempting to change that. Now, somebody that cannot see, somebody that does not understand, what do? How do you remove that?
You've got to explain it to them.
You've got to teach them. That's right. That's how ignorance is removed. It's through learning and understanding, and there has to be teaching.
We need to point out ignorance by itself is nothing wrong with.
Well, that's right.
But willful ignorance is.
That's right.
And that's exactly what we see in mankind.
Yeah. You know, one of the things we're going to see in this context of Acts chapter 17 is that ignorance is not an excuse. And ignorance does not remove consequences. You know, you might be ignorant of the harm that alcohol does to your system, let's say. But you get an automobile, get in an automobile and you're drinking, you'll find out that your ignorance of the subject does not change the outcome. It just won't. You can say, well, I was ignorant, I didn't know. Well, welcome to the real world when you're in a car crash because you were drinking, you see. You might say, well, you know, I do every once in a while smoke a cigarette or this kind of thing. Or maybe I take this particular drug or that particular drug to have the feeling that it gives me. And you say, I just don't believe that's not going to hurt. Well, just because you deny the ability of that to hurt you, does that make it simple?
No.
No, you're ignorant of it. It doesn't change the outcome. It just does. And it doesn't change the outcome here in the case of these Athenians. They were ignorant. They didn't know. But Paul's about to tell them some things they really need to understand. And when you look again at the text of Acts chapter 17, I've got to quit looking at 18. Acts chapter 17, he tells them that he does not dwell in temples made with hands. Verse 25, he's not served by man's hands as though he needed anything, seeing he himself giveth to all life and breath and all things. Fascinating text. He's the source of everything. Now, when you go back to these questions that they didn't know how to answer, what's the nature of the universe? What's Paul telling them? Where did it come from? God made it. What's the purpose of man? What's Paul telling them? Serve God. What is truth? It's what God says it is. He's the standard. Now, how do you determine what's right and what's wrong? We're going to look at these questions as we wind up, what he has to say to them. But do you see how that the answers to these questions not only are very clear, but how dramatically they change when you start at the right place? The existence of God. You see, he's self-sustaining. He's ruling. He has a purpose. Look at verse 27. I'm sorry, the latter part of verse 26. I keep getting ahead of myself. It says, he made of one every nation of men to dwell on the face of the earth. What a powerful, powerful statement. Where did mankind come from? God made him. God made man. He made of one every nation that dwells on the face of the earth. Now, if you've done very much Bible study at all, and you go back to the study of the beginning, Adam and Eve, and then you start with the days of the flood, the sons of Noah, and you begin to see where they journeyed to, and what did we find? Nations came from these people. And what does that tell you? Common origin. Common origin. We've all got, Adam, and we've all got Noah as common ancestors, don't we? We all came to the same place. Now that answers a lot of questions, doesn't it? Common origin. And when you look further in the text, he's telling them. In verse 26, look at this expression. Having determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitation. Now there are basically two views that are taken on this. I have my own view of this, but there are two that are pretty much dominant. When it says, having determined their appointed seasons, it's interesting to note how many take the position that he's talking about the seasons of the year, spring, summer, and fall, and winter. I don't believe that's what he's talking about. What's the context that he's been discussing in the previous verse, or previous statement?
The nations.
The nations. That's right. He's talking about the nations. And it tells us that God has determined their appointed seasons and the bounds of their habitations. Now, one of the things that we learn when we study from the book of Daniel, and we've been studying recently from Daniel chapter 2, what about the nations of men? Now, in our history and geography study, we've looked at that very, very carefully, and we've noted that we're talking about the same land. But when we look at the geographic boundaries of nations, they move. Depends on who's in power. Who controls that? God does. That's right. And the son of Nebuchadnezzar, what was his name? Belshazzar. He had to learn that God rules in the kingdoms of men. You see, he had to learn that. And that was difficult for him. And Daniel told him, you know, you remember your daddy? God brought him to power. You know, this is not going to last. As we see in Daniel chapter 2. Now, understanding that, some say that determined the bounds of their habitation, that God determined what land is inhabitable and what is not. And I thought about that occasionally as I drive out through the desert, you know, and I look at some of these rugged mountains and desolate lands and so forth, say, why would anybody live here? Well, I imagine somebody said that at one time about Lancaster. But you see, the point is, God did not make certain areas uninhabitable to be the context of this passage. But these people that Paul was speaking to knew the bounds of nations. And they knew the histories of nations. Well, who determined that? God did. You see, God did. And that's what he's telling them. And then in verse 27, that we'll have to start with next week, he tells us, that they should seek after God, that they might feel after him, and find him, though he is not far from each one of us, for in him we live and move and have our being. Now that just blew them away. You see, to understand that there is a God that's involved in his creation was a new thought to these folks. Now, one of the things in conclusion that I want you to take home with you is that when you begin with the existence of God, where must you end up, and where does Paul end up in his sermon? Pardon me? Well, yes, but even beyond that, if there is a God, then you're accountable. You'll answer to Him.